Hey, pull up a chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Back Porch Education Podcast. I'm Jason, here with Steve. And I'm also here with Robinson Jeffers once again. So last time was Shine Republic in honor of Plato. Today we're doing Shine Perishing Republic. While this America settles in the mold of its vulgarity, heavily thickening to empire and protest, only a bubble in the molten mass pops and sighs out, and the mass hardens, I sadly smiling remember that the flower fades to make fruit, the fruit rots to make earth. Out of the mother and through the spring exultances, ripeness and decadence, and home to the mother. You making haste, haste on decay. Not blameworthy, life is good, be it stubbornly long or suddenly a mortal splendor. Meteors are not needed less than mountains. Shine, perishing republic. But for my children, I would have them keep their distance from the thickening center. Corruption never has been compulsory. When the cities lie at the monster's feet, there are left the mountains. And boys, be in nothing so moderate as in the love of man. A clever servant, insufferable master. There is the trap that catches noblest spirits, that caught, they say, God, when he walked on earth.
Wow. So it's a lot there. I like the movement. I like the kind of countercultural notion that it's where it's happening, that center, that thickening center, as inviting as that sounds and looks. The real stuff's happening on the edges, man.
Yes.
It's a great call to the young of today who can so quickly get distracted by the siren call of what's cool, that cool is not always cool.
Right. Well, yeah, it's in vogue, but it's not helpful.
It's going to disappear. That's where he starts. And that's a great place to, you'd almost think that would be his ending, but that's where he starts. This is all going to go away. So be careful with it. Well, some things that don't go away is the great conversation we've been having for several weeks now about Plato and his Republic, and in particular, the great analogies that he gave us to use teachers in education. In some regards, I could argue that the word education itself, to lead, or to lead out, is based upon Plato's notion that's what a true teacher is supposed to be doing, is going somewhere with his students bringing them in today's discussion out of the cave. So I think at the beginning, because we don't want to spend a lot of time rehashing what he already put in better words than we probably could, we want to invite the listener, if you're not familiar in particular with the most complex of the three, and if you thought the divided line took a little bit of, if you found yourself grabbing a pencil and paper and dividing lines out with us when we were talking about it, this is even more complex. So this is a whole picture. We've provided you with a illustration of Plato's cave in the website page for this particular episode. I've also placed a link there for you if you want to go read this specific portion of the cave analogy from the Republic. Familiarize yourself with it. It's not that long and it's not that difficult.
No.
But if you have the picture in your mind, we think some of the derived ideas that we're talking about today will make more sense to you than if it's not fresh in your mind. Go refresh yourself first. It's the beauty of a podcast. It's got a pause button whenever you need to use it.
That's right. Yeah.
It's right next to the PayPal donation button. No, I'm sorry.
Good one. Nice. That was very incognito. Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah. So,
well, you and I spend a lot of time with Plato. We both get a lot from him, and I know you're kind of itching today. You got some things. I got some things. Why don't I give you first shot?
Okay.
Where do you want to start us?
Yeah, man, I appreciate that. Let me do these two things. First, I want to talk about where the cave is situated in the Republic. We're talking about forming a just society, how it would be structured. It takes hundreds of pages. But in that, we have the cave. It comes right after the other two analogies of the sun and the divided line. Immediately after the cave, though, Socrates and Glaucon jump right into discussing curriculum.
Yep.
Okay. So I think that's important. I don't know exactly how yet. I don't know what I'm going to do with that. But if I don't do something with that by the end of the episode, Steve, you do it, or someone else needs to pick it up and run with it, because that's big. So that's the first thing.
Yeah. So if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I like this. I like talking about the position of in just the right set of in a perfect outline. Plato has brought up the notion, who is best suited to lead this just society?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's got to be this philosopher king.
Exactly.
Well, how do you make that guy?
Yep.
And that's where the analogies come in. He's got to be someone that can find and handle and teach the truth.
Mm-hmm.
A just society can't happen outside the truth.
That's right.
And we face this today in so many ways. It's incredibly helpful. So before you jump into what to teach them, let me give you some analogies for how that teaching works.
Right. How the soul moves as a result of proper education.
Exactly. How this incredibly powerful eye of the soul sees things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's
good.
That's a great point you're making. I think that there's a I don't find Plato making too many missteps in his planning of his dialogues. He normally gives you what you need for the next idea to come. So
right, they're pretty tight. Let me also say, Steve, that I am proud of us because we both tend toward agricultural metaphors like grow, nurture, cultivate. But when we talked about the soul just then, I said move, how the soul moves, and you said how the soul sees. And those are both metaphors that Plato uses. So we're killing it. This is fantastic. Yeah. The other thing that I want to say sort of as an opening overture or as an entry point into the cave. Oh, okay. No pun intended. Sorry, everybody. I want to sort of describe how I was wrong in what I thought the cave was before I read it in preparation for this episode. Okay. So if you would have told me, or if you would have asked me to tell you the metaphor of the cave, then before I reread it this last time, I would have told you that everyone's chained up. And then all of a sudden this one amazing guy finds some way to bust loose and triumphantly, you know, gets out of the, chains and marches up the cave entrance and heroically steps into the sun. And when he sees the sun or when he sees the light, he is overwhelmed by that and he has some difficulty with it. But that is not what happens. Okay. Instead, you get a lot of language like passive voice, right? So, Socrates says, well, suppose there were people who were chained up, and suppose one of them was liberated. don't you think that when he stands up, he's going to be in pain from being chained down all that time? And don't you think he's going to not want to leave? And don't you think it's going to be difficult? And then suppose that he's dragged up the cave entrance, right? There's a lot of pain. He's a subject. He is not the, or let's see, what is it? He's the object, right? Not the subject. He's not the actor. He's being acted upon. Yep. And it's almost purgatorial. I don't mean like in a strictly Catholic sense. I just mean it's pain and work. And it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that he's very responsible for, this person who's being freed.
Yeah, and I think that I probably made the similar mistake that you're talking about, in that I thought the whole world's chained up, and who's the cool dude that, you know, is it Jesus or Buddha or somebody that busted out? But his analogy is that there are already people out there.
Right.
And I don't think he's talking so much about the, as you put it, heroic nature of man to lead other men, but he's talking about what you're describing, the agony that anyone goes through in trying to find truth.
Yeah.
That it's not something you stumble on. Though there may be stumbling involved, if you're going to seek out the truth, there's got to be some pain and some change, some alteration in the positioning of your soul's eye. It's got to stop staring at the wall. It's got to find itself free of the chains. It's got to get out into the light and so on. It's not going to be just a, one day I woke up and knew all truth. You know, there's a progression, I guess, is probably the best way to put this, which is important to the notion of education, that things just, there's not a snap of the fingers. This is not a, never confused with a sprint. Any teacher will tell you it's a long marathon that needs a lot of water breaks. Mm-hmm. More potty breaks than you're given. So.
Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page, send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes. Do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
Okay, so coming back from the water break, I think that you're right, Steve, that the pain or the discomfort that comes with seeking truth is inherent in sort of the process of education. But I also think it speaks volumes against me, honestly, that I glossed that in my own understanding of the cave, right? That I didn't remember that part of the cave, that I just remembered the sort of mountaintop experience or the staring at the truth experience. Try and make myself feel a little bit better and say that that's somewhat common for teachers, that it's easy for us to forget the tears and the pain that come with learning, even though we're in it all the time, right? A little bit of humility goes a long way there.
Right. And I think in particular for a teacher who's accomplished in any way, has got any kind of experience, with the constant reminder that the reason to rehearse this stuff to ourselves is we forget about all of that for the glory of what's been obtained. Once we have the truth, it's just sort of like you talking to a mother about all the agony of childbirth. But but she's not focused on that. She's focused on what happened right after that when somebody put the child in her arms.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of sort of forgetfulness about just how bad it was, you know.
Thank goodness, right?
Right. And it's not lost on me that that Greek term agony is not just a negative term. It's applied to in particular, Paul applies it to the Olympic Games, you know, that you agonize your body in order to make it ready for performance. And so,
dude, I had no idea. Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Wow. Agonistomai, I think is we get the word agony from this Greek term that meant, a severe training of the body. And I'm worried about the movement towards making, well, there's two things. One, I think you covered already with your how quickly we want to jump over this to the curriculum, that's the material that's important. If this stuff isn't there, if the proper pedagogy is not commensurate with the curriculum, all the reading in the world or all the great printed materials or the new ebooks, right? It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't work without the right methodology involved with it. But there's also the movement to try and make the curriculum and the pedagogy and everything fun. You know, I've got that ad popping up on my computer from time to time that wants to make my classroom like Minecraft. And I'm like, no, I don't. Please, no. Oh, no, thank you. I think our students have plenty of Minecraft. The last thing I want to do is go running down that road with my classroom. And I think a lot of it is born in this desire. We want to make it as easy as possible. And that's really not going to, in the end, produce the results we were hoping for.
Right. And that's it, right? We do want to make it easy as possible. I think that's good. Like, I think that's a noble thing. You know, you don't want to make something hard just for its own sake, but we also want it to be lasting. And I'll return to the analogy that Poe offers of it's the slow imprint of the seal that lets the wax take the seal or the mold or whatever, you know, so.
Right. And again, I don't think it should be difficult just for difficulty's sake.
Right. No, I know.
But I think that if it's going to be of any worth, Plato is certainly implying that some agony is going to be involved.
That's right. At each step, right? Okay. So he takes the chains off. Ow, my wrists hurt. He's stood up, right? Someone picks him up. Ow, my back hurts. I was sitting down for a long time. He's drug up the entryway. Hey, my eyes hurt. You know, actually, there's even pain when he turns around, when he gets his first look at, even though it's very filtered light, it's not the cave wall, which is what he's used to looking at. And so there's pain even in that. But get this, though. This is another thing I wanted to really bring out. Another part of the analogy I completely forgot about was after he gets out, right? Then he goes back in the cave. Okay, we all know that. But it was the reaction. I misjudged or I misremembered that the reaction of those in the cave, their reaction is not to kill him, not first. Their first reaction is to laugh at him.
Right, like he's deranged.
Right, because why? Because he can't see.
Yeah.
Because his eyes have adjusted to the sun, that is, because his soul has adjusted to the truth, when he's plunged into darkness, he can't argue well, he can't reason well, he can't see well, and so they laugh at him. Mm-hmm. And it's only then that Plato says, if anyone else tried to release somebody, they would be killed. Because they don't want, because the people in the cave don't want to be made into an idiot like this guy.
Well, I think it's the whole ball of wax. They saw his pains getting out of the cave.
Right.
And they see what getting out of the cave's done to him once he returns. Why would I want to be like that guy?
you know? Right.
Leave me alone.
What's a good question?
Leave the abscess tooth alone in my mouth. We're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, but that's a real question. Like, so sort of sitting out of the analogy, we of course look at the people in the cave and have pity on them. But if being in the cave is all I knew, then yes, that, like, it is a legitimate question. Why would I want to be made like him? He can't see now, and he was hurting a lot.
Well, and this is a big deal to me, because how you answer that, their question, okay, really forms the appetite of that student. If you say to them, well, you need to be like me so you can make a good living, or give them practical reasons how this is going to help them, they may feel like, well, they may think they're a way to the same practical outcome without all the pain.
Yeah.
But if you're able to, and I think it almost has to be illustrated rather than just told, if you're able to show them that this is what real freedom is, that your chains are really not freedom. And I think that's at the heart of Plato's point.
Yeah.
You feel like this is normal life, to be chained up like this. It's not. And if you have any, you know, if you can get the appetite to be free, then you'll go through all the difficulty I've gone through to be such. I think we try and con kids too much. I think we try and tell them how geometry is going to help them figure the circumference of their fire pit out back when they go to build it, or something like that.
Right.
And not really get involved in showing them that it's all a part of understanding a world that we live in, and that we want to live in well, and that we want to be happy in, and that happiness is directly related to the heart set free to see the world as it really is, not as it's pretending to be. But
it reminds me of, like, that sort of thing leads to, like, the memes that you'll see, which this one's hilarious, dude. I don't care. Like, you'll see every, you know, March or April, where it says, like, somebody will say something like, oh gosh, what is it? Man, I sure am glad I went to school. That class is really coming in handy this algebra season.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or this geometry season or whatever.
Well, we pick on math in particular because, you know, it's math. And and if you're a practically minded person, I've got to be adding or subtracting or algebraicizing something. I've got to be it's got to be a one-to-one correlation in their mind, and it's not. It's the soul formed by these truths, not the tacit abilities stolen from the art, if you follow what I'm saying. Because you could take art class all day long, and very few people are going to turn that into a nickel. Most of them are going to turn it into pure enjoyment. Right. And that's the point.
Exactly.
It's not bringing everything to a monetized position in life as important as it is to make a decent living. I think as you go about enjoying life, you figure out how to get the good life thrown in there, including a few bucks to feed yourself and clothe your family and that sort of thing.
Good. Well, we're kind of diving into a conversation of what the end of education is, right? Like, or maybe not the end, but what the emphasis is on with process, or the process of education, the curriculum, the product, what the product is. Maybe we can explore some of those questions after we're back from the break.
While this show is a back porch discussion, it does cost a little bit of money. So if you're liking what you hear, consider helping us out. You can simply use the donation button on the website to send along a one-time gift, or we have subscriber plans for those who want to commit to regular support. Subscribers can get premium rewards depending on how nice a chair you pull up on the porch. We have everywhere from sitting on the floor to our finest rocking chair available. But whatever you can do, know that it helps us keep the conversation going. And for that, we heartily thank you.
Okay, Steve. So coming back from the break, I have said what I wanted to say in regards to the cave, but tell me what you're thinking about when you think about the cave.
Well, you've emphasized sort of the pain, and I want to talk just a little bit about the joy.
Okay, good, good.
There's no doubt, and I guess I kind of go into sports because it's an analogy I understand well. I've done a lot of sports over the years. When I was younger as a participant and now older as a coach, you want the euphoric enjoyment of truth. There is something about the truth that just fits, right? It brings the properly used term here is joy, insight, delight, harmony to your life for a moment anyway. And it sometimes gets all messed up again, right? But for the moment, the puzzle is coming together and I'm seeing things. I believe this is part and parcel of the whole cave analogy is as he's out there, the sun is in very bright ways revealing to him how it all really works. And it's okay. Now, and that delight is something that we're seeking, but the pain that you've been talking about is the precursor to that. So my soccer players, for instance, don't want to run a mile at the beginning of every soccer practice. They want to go play soccer. Well, I want you to go play soccer too. I really want to work on our skills and I want to work on our teamwork and whatnot. But it does me no good to work on any of that if, you know, a fourth of the way through the game, you're all lying on the field because you can't run, you know. So let's work on that too. It isn't fun. It isn't the bright and glorious moments of aha. It's all the difficulty getting there. So to illustrate this and what this looks like in my classroom, probably the hardest thing I get seniors to do in my seminar class is what they think it's very difficult to read something like Plato or Augustine or Aquinas or whatnot. And it is difficult to read those things. But the hardest thing they do is form their own thesis paper because the sort of gripey old Mr. Eliot isn't satisfied with their initial half-hearted efforts.
Right.
They find me pushing them and pushing them. I assign each of them a faculty member who acts as their sounding board, and that advisor, when they're doing their best, is pushing them, asking them more questions. Got a young lady right now who really knows what her side says, but she doesn't have much interest in going and finding out what the other viewpoints are. And as I promised her from the beginning, I'm not letting you off the hook. This paper, eventually, willingly or unwillingly, you're going to reveal all the sides to this issue, or you're not really yet ready to say your side of the issue. And so I just value that. I think it's a great reason for my seniors early on in the seminar, and we do it chronologically, so Plato's towards the beginning, but these are important analogies to them because they recognize, okay, there is the really good stuff, the stuff that still has Mr. Eliot, you know, stretching himself, is going to stretch us, and we're not going to feel real comfortable. We're not going to be thrilled about having someone trying to get the chains off and get us out of here. There's a lot of happiness, falsely called happiness, that can be found, bliss that can come from our ignorance.
Sure.
But I want to be able to think for myself, and so I've got to work at that.
Yeah, so let me hop in there because you ended with a kind of a sports metaphor, and I want to use a religious metaphor or character, kind of getting after that same thing. The last thing that struck me about this reading of the cave was when Socrates says to Glaucon, when somebody sees somebody else whose vision is perplexed and weak. Now I'm not saying exactly what Plato said, but if he is ignorant, then he'll laugh right away. right? When he sees someone who can't see, he'll laugh right away. But someone who is wise won't laugh right away for this reason. He will first ask whether that soul of the man has come out of the brighter life and is back into the unaccustomed dark, or he has turned from the darkness to the day and is dazzled by the excess of light. So I think that's really awesome. You know, there's two ways that the vision can be impaired, or the soul, continuing it on, can be impaired, right? Either after having experienced greater truth and now coming back into the murky waters, or beholding truth for the first time,
yeah,
or to a greater degree. And I think that it's really important that we not be so prideful as to think that we're standing in the greatest light that anyone has ever stood in before.
Right.
Right. So when someone comes to you and they're talking and you're not quite making sense of it and they seem to be stumbling all over themselves, it may be that they just don't know as much as you. But it could also be that they are struggling to communicate to you greater truth than you have seen.
Yep.
And the analogy or the character that comes to mind for me in that is the Holy Fool that is so popular in Russian literature, right? This he seems like a fool, but it's because he's experienced something so great that now these categories that you have imposed on the world don't make any sense to him anymore.
Yeah, it's the sort of age-old question, who's blowing whose mind?
Right.
You know, it could be that I'm about to explode your mind by having seen some truth you're not at yet. And that's my general, this is the danger of teaching, is the assumption is, and with discrete information, okay, like when I'm in a biology classroom, rarely do I have a student, just because of years of reading, rarely do they know more than I do about X, Y, or Z biologically.
Sure.
I have more knowledge than they do. But the seminar class is dangerous because I might walk in and as Jesus said, out of the mouth of babes, this truth that has escaped me for years is suddenly crashing in on me. But in particular, if this is new to them and me, we're both kind of struggling to see it, them to express it and me to understand what it is they're trying to express. So Augustine's notion that humility is the key to education, just a principle that I don't think this podcast is going to get over. There's so much there. That's kind of the cool thing, even in this conversation, right? A year or two, 5 years from now, you and I could do another podcast or series of podcasts on Plato's allegories, and we'd have entirely different material. The cool thing about the really useful, the bright light of the sun is that it's still blinding 50 years in, you know. So it's great, great stuff. And I think it can't be overemphasized. This is the kind of stuff that prepares one to both go further up and further in a classroom, and to reflect the leisure. I know you and I want to do something on Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Far too many classrooms are in too much of a hurry, and Plato and his analogies give us room to slow down and soak it all in. There's a great deal of freedom for a teacher here if they prepare themselves this way. The curriculum isn't quite so daunting.
Yeah, I couldn't say it any better. Slow down, soak it in, and behold truth.
Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.